In his expanded commentary on this particular reading, Swamiji quotes from St. Paul, I believe, something that I'd heard many times. Faith is it's usually said the proof of things unseen. Swami wrote it, faith is the evidence of things unseen. The great fun I have found over many decades of studying these teachings is that every so often you learn something that you just didn't know. Even though you've heard exactly the same words 100 times, all of a sudden something means something to you. I've heard that statement of Paul, faith is the proof of things unseen, hundreds of times probably. I've never had the foggiest idea what it meant. And I just passed right over it because I knew so little of what it meant that I didn't even want to ponder it. Swamiji, in his commentary, explains it in a way that at least I find very interesting, and I hope that you do. This is how he puts it. He starts by saying that evidence means something tangible that cannot be contradicted. When you give evidence of something happening, it proves that that's what it is. That's the proof, the word evidence. I'm not defining it very well. So what Swami is saying, if faith is what proves the world beyond this world, then it can't be a blind faith, is the word he used. Because a blind faith wouldn't provide any evidence. It would just be saying, I believe it. And where's the evidence in that? I mean, you may believe it, but how does it in any way communicate anything to anyone else? So he says it has to be an experience. I mean, it has to be faith that is based because you have actually experienced it. And you've experienced to the point where there's just no question about it. There's no place in your thinking for an alternative to this one. In this context, I've heard Swamiji also say, I heard Swamiji say over on many different times, he talked about what you would have to think of as the most horrific period in the history of Christianity, when they were all being rounded up and fed to the lions. I mean, it's a fairly gruesome picture if you imagine being one of them, not one of the lions, but one of them being fed to the lions. It's just a terrifying prospect. But nonetheless, most, all of those who were being killed in this most barbaric and frightening of manner for one reason and one reason only, because they refused to repudiate their absolute faith in Jesus. They believed that Jesus had been born, that he died on the cross for the sake of all of us, that he was resurrected and that death couldn't touch him, and that these people who never met him, I mean, this was, you know, many, many long years after Jesus, they only knew about Jesus from generations of disciples. And yet their conviction was so powerful that they would rather be thrown to the lions than repudiate it. I mean, repudiating it is just words. All you just say is, oh yeah, I didn't really mean it. Yeah, if you're going to really take such offense by it, I'll just go and be a pagan again. No problem. Show me where the temple is. Because that was their choice. They had to go worship the pagan gods, and then they would be spared this terrible fate. But they refused to do it. And knowing exactly, and these were not people, these were people of prominence, young people, families, mothers leaving their children, fathers leaving their families. I mean, it was not like there were no consequences of this. Oh, darn it. Drinking my coffee without milk. That's my tapasya, hoping that this will go away. But we're still stuck. But it was not as if there were no consequences for their actions. It wasn't as if the anguish of doing it wasn't tremendous, but the anguish of not doing it was worse. Now, of course, part of the belief which sustained them was that when they died, they would be taken into heaven. They would be with Jesus. But still, all of this, I mean, you can say all those things, but those are all words. But at some point, it ceased to be just words. And now this is what Swami comments in this reading also. He said, truth is not a careful definition. It's a state of consciousness. It's a state of consciousness in which we live. So these people could assert the truth that Jesus was resurrected, that if I die faithful, that I will, what, go to heaven forever? That was, I think, how they thought about it at that time. But those are just words. Those are just definitions of what they called the truth. But it had to be a state of consciousness, because definitions alone do not allow you to go singing into the Colosseum and stand there to meet a wild animal that's going to tear you to pieces. So what the phrase from St. Paul was, which was long before this happened, that the faith that they have is the proof that there is something out there. Because it would be impossible for people to have that much power in their faith just by definitions. They had to experience the consciousness of perfect love, of someone who was taking care of them, of eternal life, of the belief that even if I'm leaving my loved ones behind, we won't be separated, that honor, death before dishonor, all of these words which are so beautiful. And Swamiji has made the statement on a number of occasions that Christianity was created by the faith of those martyrs. That the faith of those who were willing to die had so much power in itself. There's this certain rule, a divine law, that some kind of tapasya is always required for something to be created. I remember when an Indian teacher came to Ananda, it was in the late 70s, so we were 10 years into it, but already a tremendous amount had been created. And this Indian teacher said to Swami Kriyananda, somebody, and he meant him, did a great deal of tapasya. Tapasya means self-sacrifice. But tapasya means more than just, oh, you have the last sandwich, I'll get lunch later. It's more than that. Tapasya is an act of extreme determined focus out of devotion to a higher ideal. And if you think about it in a certain way, anything that you try to accomplish, really try to accomplish, requires a concentrated focus of energy. When I would watch Swamiji do the many different projects he did during the years, sometimes he would be writing music, sometimes books, sometimes working on photography and creating presentations using his photography. But he would always be so completely focused during the time. And he would say, when he was writing music, he couldn't even imagine how he could write a book. And when he was writing a book, he just didn't even know how he could ever write music. And at one point, when he was working on the oratorio, the beautiful presentation about the life of Christ, and he was so intensely engaged in it, and there was a few of us having dinner together, and Swami seemed a little distracted, and Devi said, I have the feeling, sir, when you look at me, you're trying to decide what key I'm in. You know, before you can't just relate to me as a person. You have to know my key and then what part of the melody, and then you can come out. And he laughed and he said, that's pretty much exactly right. It's just human speech even was difficult because it wasn't melodic and it wasn't what he was doing. But that kind of focused energy, because there's infinite energy around us all the time, but only a few people can actually channel that energy. And it requires the devotion of choosing what you're going to do and then directing all this energy and pulling all this energy through it. This is tapasya in its highest form. In all great epics, whenever the hero has to go accomplish something, he first goes off into the forest and does penance for a long period of time. In the Indian epics, he does penance until the gods come and grant him a boon. Lord Shiva comes, Lord Vishnu comes and grants him a boon. But the boon comes because there's been so much determination to make this happen. And so looking at Ananda, and seeing what had just been manifested out of nothing, and really nothing. There was nothing there at all. He said, somebody's done a lot of tapasya. Very modestly, Swami said, yes, just like that. Many years before he really talked about, I mean, he took a lot of it in his body. He had terrible arthritic hips for 20 years. When he finally had his hips replaced, the surgeon said to him, he said, I don't know how you were standing up. He said, with deterioration in your bones, he said, you should have at least been in a wheelchair. I'm not surprised if you'd been bedbound. And Swami just carried on. When I asked him afterwards, I said, how did you do that, sir? He said, well, he said, there were so many obstacles to be overcome in the starting of Ananda. He said, I never focused on the pain in my body as anything separate from all the others. It was just this huge array of things that had to be done, and one was to carry around the body with a terrible pain in the hips, and that was the way it was. After our 20th anniversary, Swamiji actually felt Ananda could walk on its own. And then he went and had the operation. When he was in India in 2003, when he first moved to India to start our work over there, he just had terrible ill health. He got pneumonia in both lungs and his head was having congestive heart failure. I mean, Swamiji just used his body in this way. And he was in this, for a while he would go to this hospital, this very small, informal hospital there in Gurgaon where he was living. Subsequently, either they built or we became associated with a very modern hospital that people travel across the world to go to. But at this time, it was this little hospital that was sort of like a, what you would call it? Like a small hotel. And Swami checked in and out of it so often that he just had his own room virtually. He'd sort of walk in and the doctor or the nurse would say, you want the same room? And he'd go up and take the same room and we'd all kind of hang around with him there. So I was in his hospital room and he would go there because of the heart, and it was the only way to get him to rest. And so this Indian sadhu, I never saw him before or since, I don't know his name, he heard about Swami Kriyananda and came to see him. And the sadhu expressed great sympathy for Swamiji lying there in his bed. And very airily, Swami said, oh, don't be concerned, I'm just doing the tapasya needed to start the work in India. I mean, he didn't normally talk about it like that, but sadhu to sadhu he did, and I was just eavesdropping. Oh, I'm just, you know, just doing what's needed, concentrating the energy. So we have, I'm coming back to the Christians being thrown to the lions. Swamiji made the comment, it was just the necessary tapasya to really establish in this world the power of the teachings of Christ. Because there's one side of it, which is those who were dying there. The other side of it is those who are watching them die. Now, of course, why do they come to watch people die? But it was the sport of the time. I believe someday some people are going to ask, why do we come to watch people play football? But that's just my particular opinion, not everybody else's, you know. If you actually just parse it apart, but never mind. We're just moving forward on these things. But in any case, it had to make an impression on those who had any sensitivity. You know, there's a proof here of something, because look what those people are doing. And what the whole subject of today is about those who received him. To those who received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. Now there's really so much in that, because what we're talking about is something comes that we don't already have that makes us into something other than we presently are. It's such an interesting relationship. And it even says all those who received him. There's no limiting condition about where you were born or where you immigrated to or what your education is or what you did to deserve it. None of that. Received. To all those who received him, to them gave he power. And then all of a sudden we have something that's our power, but that power started from somewhere other than ourselves. And this is where Master takes it into his own words. Master always talked about the power of attunement. And in another place, Swamiji writes, he said when Master talked in public, he talked about many things. And there's this wonderful email that comes out every day from Crystal Clarity at Ananda Village, Crystal Clarity Publishers. It's called, On This Day in History, Paramahansa Yogananda Was. And then they'll give you as many as they can track in 1927, in 1938, in 1942. And much of the time, he was in some American city giving some kind of lecture. The esoteric link between Judaism and Hinduism, overcoming racism, how to find a perfect soulmate, secrets of everlasting life, just any topic you could think of, success in the business world, how to be a hero in whatever, anything you wanted. Master was talking about it. And he was just bringing these teachings in the most, really, the most creative and remarkable and expansive ways. But Swamiji said when he was with the disciples, not when he was talking to thousands of people who'd never even seen a Hindu before, and were so fascinated by him, and he was doing feats of strength and miracles of body control, and for a while he traveled with this Egyptian man named Ahmed Bey, who could be buried in sand or buried underwater. I mean, he wasn't a magician, Ahmed. He was a true sadhu, but he also had all these powers. I mean, it was a show. And then he would go to all these service clubs and Lions clubs and Rotary clubs and women's clubs and synagogues and just talk about everything. But when he was with the disciples, he talked about attunement. That's what Swamiji said. That's what he talked about, the fact that there's a subtle exchange of magnetism, and that is what the spiritual path comes down to. Here we have, this woman didn't meditate very much, but she became very highly advanced. She got there by attunement. And another woman who couldn't meditate very well, the Master said, don't worry, I'll meditate for you. Master says, people may leave the path, but it doesn't have to happen if they stay in tune. And now we come to truth is not a definition, it's a state of consciousness. So what kind of consciousness are we in? What is it that we're experiencing? Well, clearly we're experiencing the reality of the Guru's presence, of God's presence, of the fact that when we receive him, we receive power. Those Christians who walk singing to their deaths, said goodbye to their loved ones and walk singing to their deaths, that is power. That's not something that you can just pretend. I mean, that you can't be a hypocrite and do that. I mean, everything is down, and you know that there's something there. How do you know that? Well, according to the Bible and according to Master, you receive it. We don't just generate it from inside ourselves. We try so hard to be strong, but the real strength is that strength of receptivity, the realization of who and what we really are. You know, the biggest difficulty in our culture, our society, our world right now, you know, all of the confusion that we can call politics or government or wars or anything, it all has to do with our lack of understanding that we are part of a greater reality. When we do the festival a few minutes from now, listen how many times it says, you are a part of all that is. Let us celebrate our own greater reality, waves on the sea. What does that mean? That means that even though I draw this circle around myself and live within my own little framework here, this separation is the illusion. And attunement is to be attuned to the fact that this separation is an illusion, which I can affirm in words and assert philosophically. But when I'm walking out to be eaten by this lion, if I think that all I am is this, this would be terrified. And this it might still be terrified. But if it knows that it's part of a greater reality, and this little bit is going to be taken away now. You know, we can tell the difference between truth as a careful definition and an actual consciousness by how we respond to the world around us. It's just as simple as that. How shocked we are when we trip on something, how angry we are when somebody misbehaves, how easily our energy just slips away from us and we get irate and can't stop being irate. Once I kindly describe myself as I easily become irate and can tend to stay there for a while. I would like to try to put that in the past tense. Swamiji had this marvelous way of seeing people extremely clearly, but always in such a kind manner. He had this phrase. There was one person who was, I mean, there are not many people, including myself, who can be obnoxious at times. And this one person just irritated everyone, and Swami said about her, yes, he said, she does have an unfortunate manner, is how he put it. It was such so sweet. I've always remembered that. So-and-so has an unfortunate manner, because that is distinct from who and what they truly are. Because each one of us is just as good as good can be. Because outside of all this confusion of separateness, there's always this pure light of spirit, this pure light that's always there. But sometimes we do have an unfortunate manner. And an unfortunate manner can be just personality, or it can be a lack of attunement. Because we talk a good philosophical line, but then easily become irate and stay there for a while. You know, as soon as we become irate, what are we saying? We're saying the world ought to be different than it is. And I know. And it ought to be different in the ways that I perceive is better. Isn't that self-evident? This is what the little bird says. What else is wisdom except to keep what is mine for myself? The little bird, this is our festival of light, for those of you who haven't yet heard it. Little bird is sent out on this mission. Be fruitful in the gifts that God has given you. You know, expand and multiply them and share with everyone, because you are a part of all that is. And the little bird started having a lot of fun on his own. And he decided instead that it was much better to just gather and hoard for himself and just make his self more and more separate and more big. That's what we see happening around us in the world now. If you can get it, keep it. Doesn't really even matter anymore how you get it. If you can, just keep it. I mean, we used to have sort of a code of ethics on the planet, but that's long since gone. Now it's just, if you can get it, keep it. Somebody used that marvelous phrase, the post-truth age. I love that. I mean, that's just like, wow, where are we? But why not? Because if you're not part of a greater reality, what does it matter? If it's only you, I mean, that is a complete lack of attunement. That is receiving nothing. That is just using my energy to get what I want. And that's what the little bird does. Little bird says, what else is wisdom except to keep what is mine for myself? Which is a convenient bit of scripture to quote whenever you feel like it. I remember once sitting with his parents. You know, parents are so eager for their children to be spiritual, and they're always looking at any sign that their children are spiritual. And some children are. But I remember this little girl, she was just so darling. She was about 2, and she was singing in her little lisping way, Lord, I am thine, I am thine, I am thine, Lord. And everybody's, oh, she's so darling. And then somebody handed her a bottle, and she sang, Lord, this is mine, this is mine, this is mine. Sometimes we just flip, don't we? And the little bird in the festival, it says, you know, he decided this was wisdom, to keep what is mine for myself. And then in the poetic way of the festival, it says, and even though repeatedly he lost everything he had, and there you have it, don't you? We live without attunement. We're not attuned to God, we're not attuned to a greater reality, and even though repeatedly we lost everything we have, we lose our health, we lose our happiness, we lose our relationships, eventually we lose our money, not always in one incarnation, because if you have enough energy, you can get away with it. And that's what's confusing everyone. If you can be rich until the day you die, who cares how you got it? And there's just no karma, there's no reincarnation. When When Ananda was sued a zillion years ago, it's history. Some of you weren't even born when all of this happened. But anyway, we had a big adventure, and we were in a lawsuit, and then eventually we were in two lawsuits, and eventually we were attacked morally. I mean, we were told that we were morally reprehensible is actually the simple phrase for it, and a jury was persuaded that we were. And when the verdict came down, and these people who had just created this insane series of accusations, and part of the reason we lost is they were so nuts, we couldn't imagine that it could carry the day, but we were also so naive, we didn't know it could carry the day. So anyway, a jury decided that perhaps we were morally reprehensible. And I'm extremely proud of myself, because in the moment that that verdict came down, the first thought I had was this enormous compassion for the people who'd brought the case against us and lied, created so many vicious lies to get that verdict. My first thought was, oh dear, not only have they done this dishonorable thing, but now they've won, which will increase the delusion that this was a good idea. And even more and more will they have to pay for this. I mean, not pay money. We had to pay the money. But not pay money. But oh my, my, what will come of this? And thank you, God, it was my spontaneous response. It's like, what does this matter to me? I mean, those Christians were taken to the lions because the crazy world they lived in thought that that's what you ought to do. If you believed in Jesus, you should be thrown to the lions. So, I mean, the Christians, what did they say? They're looking around for some kind of support in the society around them. They're thinking, I love Jesus, I'm such a good person, all of you people should take care of me. And what happens? They get swept up and thrown to the beasts, ripped to pieces and die. But they held to their faith. I mean, why is it any different for us? We've been very fortunate. We live in a very supportive society, but not always. We went through 12 years of crazy litigation in which the whole society, just the whole system just turned against us and, you know, chewed us to bits, partially. We partially won, we partially lost. Didn't really make any difference. But when we're judged morally reprehensible, you have to ask yourself, am I? I mean, it doesn't matter, am I? You have to say yes or no. Those Christians were considered reprehensible enough to be killed. Jesus was crucified. Was it justified? You can't look outside yourself. Evidence, faith is evidence of things unseen. If you're just being supported by all the people around you, where's the faith? Swamiji said once the worst thing that happened to Christianity was when Constantine was victorious in the name of the cross and then everybody in the country became a Christian. Who was a Christian then? You know, was there faith? Was there the power of that which wasn't seen then? See, this is what all who received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. That's not just a nice person who goes to church. That's someone who knows. That's what's being asked of us. Nothing less. For one reason only. Because that's what we need in ourselves. That's what we long for. Is that kind of understanding that nothing in this world can touch. God bless you.